As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Movies That Made Me, with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
I'm really psyched. Tell me... Is this possible that I feel like, because we're going back now long enough that who the hell knows what I remember correctly. There was this movie that you would hear about in certain circles. And while I cannot pass as a true hardcore horror nerd, I am a fan and I have at least enough of a toe in that world that I have friends who are very, very deeply immersed in it. And this was back in the day, for some of our younger listeners, there was a thing called VHS. Which stood for, what did that stand for, Joe? I don't even.
Very high shit.
Very, very hard to see, actually, in retrospect. And people would give you sometimes, you know, through the dark underground grapevine, you get these tapes, like third or fourth generation of some great movie that someone had stumbled across somewhere. And there was this vampire movie called Habit. And I remember watching it, and there was something about, and I don't want to dismiss the work that went into it by all these, you know, tremendously gifted craftspeople, but there was something about it that really worked on third generation VHS that just added to the kind of discomfort of the thing. And that was really the first time. I mean, obviously I'd seen our guest in things before and sort of gone, oh yeah, that guy, I like that guy. But for me, at least, this was sort of the arrival of Larry Fessenden as a horror filmmaker. To be reckoned with. And it's been fascinating to me to watch that grow into this kind of industry almost of kind of independent horror, and then you branched out into other things. And, you know, living here in LA, we're like, anyone who's not doing it in LA is doing it somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. New York, is that where it was? I've heard of New York. Larry's been making sort of really interesting and incredible films, like with I wrestle with your aesthetic all the time. I read somebody sort of, there was a John Cassavetes comment somebody made once. I thought that's not unfair. You're just a really interesting filmmaker, and he's in a new film that is about to come out called Jacob's Wife with Barbara Crampton, which I described to somebody as it's the Phantom Thread with vampires. I love movies about codependency. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want to ruin anything. But you're terrific in that, and as always. But you didn't direct that one. And were you involved in its distribution as well, or was this? You just showed up to play.
I pretty much just showed up to play. Although the truth is that Barbara had approached me somewhat a couple of years ago and said, do you want to play Jacob? And then she was still toying around with the script. And she said, you have any ideas for people who might help do another polish? So, you know, she was engaging me a little bit as a fellow producer of indie pictures. But in the end, she went off, figured her thing out, and then brought me in to play the role. So it's nice to walk on and just be on a set as an actor. You're still contributing in a low budget film. You're still helping build the movie. And I knew the director, Travis Stevens, and I knew Barbara. So we felt like we were all working together, but it was her picture and I was just there to serve.
Fantastic. No, it's a delight, if one can say such a thing about such a movie. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, when your name came up, I was like, that's a guy I'd love to get on our show. You seem tailor-made for it. It's like, we don't talk to you about your work. That's it. We're not going to say another word about it. If you don't know, like, everyone.
I was talking about The Last Winter. What? The Last Winter, my favorite.
Oh, is that your favorite?
Well, any movie where people freeze their balls off to make the movie, I'm in awe. I can't do that anymore. Even Vancouver is too cold for me now.
We filmed in Iceland in the dead of winter, and we did have to shut down for a blizzard or two. It was really fantastic, and yet oddly enough, the crew didn't complain at all compared to like my New York. Indie crews will complain if lunch is 5 minutes late, but here in the middle of a blizzard, the Icelanders never bitched at all. They were very accommodating. It was a great, I really love the robustness of it. So yeah, Joe, I myself am getting a little soft in my old age, but that was back at the peak when I was ready for adventure, raised on Werner Herzog aesthetic, you know.
those Icelanders are hardy people.
They are hardy indeed.
It's the cold. I can't do the cold thing. It's I can't, and it's not, the weird thing about that movie is it was not foisted on you. You wrote it. You sat there and went, I'm going to set a movie in this incredibly cold place that I'm then going to have to go work in. And
but you originally planned to shoot it on sets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, my producer took me all the way to Alaska, the northern climb. The northernmost city in Alaska where they drill for oil. And that was so cold that I remember we were out exploring and I started feeling like my fingers were losing their touch. And I just abandoned my friend I just went back to the tiny little hotel and I realized this is the meaning of cowardice. I am not sure that every man's coming out of this alive. I'm only taking care of number one.
Have you ever thought of setting a horror film in, say, Tahiti?
That was always the joke, I can assure you. during the last winter, that's all we talked about, the sequel that was in the Bahamas.
Yeah. Well, my hat is off to you for all of that. And but anyway, yeah, we'd love to talk to you, though, about the films that have inspired you along the way, the stuff that turned you on, set you on fire, made you want to do this.
Well, I sent you guys a list. It's a fairly standard list, I suppose.
We pretend you didn't, that's all.
Oh, I see.
And Joe never sees them. Joe has no idea what's coming.
Well, I would love to talk about the movies that made my passion for film really ignite. You know, there's classic films to talk about, and then there's all the odd sort of unexpected ones that come your way and sort of make an impact even though you're not quite sure why or you can't even remember. Those are my favorites, like the attack of a crab. What is it called?
Crab Monsters.
Yeah, that movie, like, what the hell? It still haunts me to this day.
Seriously?
But it's a very unusual movie. I mean, it's a movie where the monsters absorb people's minds and can speak in the voices of the people that they eat.
Yo, you know, another one of that nature. Do you know the film The Crawling Eye?
Oh, yeah.
One of the weirdest movies. These people are stuck in a hotel, and then on the mountain is this big eye, which is sort of made out of cellophane or something. But these are movies that haunt you, and you're sort of indefinable. And it's what keeps you loving horror because they're so off kilter. But
well, there is that thing that, yeah, literally anything can happen.
Yeah,
which is always kind of nice, you know. If it's a couple sitting and arguing over their marriage, there's kind of a limit as to what can happen. But
well, that's why you make a genre version of the Cassavetes. That was
exactly
the point about
exactly.
Me was. Making horror films as if he was Cassavetes in the 1930s Universal Studios. So I love that combo because that really is kind of my orientation.
So what like when you saw, was The Crawling Eye something you saw early or is that something that hit you later in life?
Oh, good Lord, no. These are childhood memories that I can't quite distract from my actual life. But, you know, when I was little, I was a New Yorker. And if I was lucky, my parents would go on day trips during the weekend, and I would sit in front of the TV and watch the horror movie of the hour. You know, we had Chiller Theater, and we had the Million Dollar Movie and all these different. And every Sunday you'd look in the New York Times and you could map out your whole week when the movies were playing. This was actually before VHS, regarding your VHS story. So I grew up when movies were very precious, and it was all very illusory. And you know, you didn't even always see the movie. Sometimes you just read the magazine or the horror comic that had a picture. Like, there's a movie called The Reptile Lady, and it's this amazing still of this woman who has a reptile skin. And I've never seen the movie, but it's sort of seminal in my mind. And
well, yeah, that was, yeah, you conjure with them, right? As a child, you start to imagine what could possibly happen. And
you couldn't rewatch movies like the kids today. They just, well, now they stream, but even, you know, VHS and DVD. So spoiled, these kids, because in my day, it was your memory of something or even your conjuring of it, you know, from a single photograph or poster. All this was very essential.
And if you missed it, you had to wait for maybe another year before they might run it again, you know.
Amazing.
I mean, I remember as a kid, I think I've talked about this in the show, I remember as a kid just hearing over and over again about Michael Powell's Peeping Tom, which was a film that was never going to show up on TV.
Yeah,
and I grew up in Philadelphia, and then one day it showed up at the TLA, which is a great repertory theater downtown, on a weekday. And I skipped school to go sit through like four showings of it, because who knew that you would ever get a chance to see it again, you know? I wanted to have a recording of it in my head.
Absolutely. Well, you know what I used to do is I used to record movies on cassette.
On audio, yes.
Audio cassette. And as a result, I mean, I know all the footsteps in Casablanca, you know? It's not just it's not just the damn piano playing and the, you know, here's looking at you, kid. It was the all the little moments. And it made me really love sound design and realize how much that's part of the world of a film.
Yeah.
And even Jaws, one of my favorite movies in later in life, I snuck a tape recorder into the theater. And I thought that it might as well have been a grand heist of the highest order. You know, it's sweat dripping down my brow as the film. And then the one, you had to flip the cassette. And I know by heart, but I don't know the beginning of Quint's speech because I let the cassette run out. So it's one of the tragedies of my life. So all of this just speaks of our generation, my generation, when all of this was more precious. Media was much more elusive. And you had to fill in the blanks. And
that I just had this almost Proustian flashback to that thudding in my heart when you're flipping the cassette and the movie's quiet and you're worried someone might hear you know what you're doing. And what are my parents going to do if I miss high school to spend it in jail?
I know, it was literally, this is a felony. And Spielberg will hear about this.
Oh, God. Yeah, you'll never work in show business if that happens. But did you ever take something like Reptile Woman or some film that you hadn't seen that you played? Did you ever write or start to write at least the movie that had appeared in your head?
Well, in a way, although speaking of Jaws, the funny thing is that I was so obsessed with that movie that I built the boat 6 feet long out of balsa wood with everything down to the little tiny beer cans. And it was to scale with G.I. Joes, which are foot tall little dolls in the old days. And I shaved the dolls to look like Brody and Hooper. And then I took the boat out into the pond and I filmed a little bit of it. I wrote the script, and in my script, the shark wins.
We're off and running now in your career.
So I admit I never finished this film, but there are little snippets online, and the boat is gorgeous as a act of sort of hubris and folly both at once, and all the details, every single harpoon I handcrafted, and you know, the barrels were made out of little spice jars, if you picture painting those yellow. And it's really an act of mania.
Do you still have this artifact?
Yes, it's in the basement of my parents' home in Cape Cod.
It's great. In a bottle.
Oh, a very big bottle.
And what did you make the shark out of?
More folly. I mean, these are really why I think it was very clear I was never going to be a successful filmmaker, because I just made some bad decisions. So I made it out of wire and then paper mache, which I think we can all recognize quite quickly is not
on water.
So then I had the brilliant idea of covering the paper mache with liquid rubber, which I did. And it survived one or two outings. And enough to get me in the local Cape Cod paper. But then the shark is now just this sort of sagging. It's a very, very sad example of my ambition not quite hitting the road.
So were you forced then to shoot around it to find new ways to create? Because that seems like...
Just like the movie.
I felt very a kinship to Spielberg with my struggles.
Yes. I think we should do a new thing, because we are talking about his work, Joe. It should be like, we can only talk about movies that inspired you and movies you made before you were 16.
That may cut down on the guest list.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man, that's fantastic. Well, cool. Well, give us another movie.
Well, one movie that I wanted to bring up, because I don't even know the director, which shows how sort of obscure it is, but it was a fulcrum in my life. It's Man of a Thousand Faces. And it just was sort of, I was so obsessed with Lon Chaney. And once again, this was all mostly from the magazines. I wasn't doing the hard research of watching, you know, silent movies, but the images of Chaney and his makeup and the whole idea of being a thousand faces, and don't step on it, it might be Lon Chaney. All of this was, you know, Forrest Ackerman, of course, wrote all these goofy gags in the pages of Famous Monsters. Anyway, I loved him. Then I loved Karloff and Jack Pierce and the whole legacy of these films. And along came this movie that was a biopic of Lon Chaney. And I loved it because he had a tragic life, and that appealed to my, you know, my morose sensibility. But it was played by James Cagney. And this is how I learned to love movies through actors, because previously it was like Karloff and, you know, they were really actors who were playing monsters. So it wasn't quite as much about performing.
Right.
And I really hooked into Cagney. And then I started watching all the Warner Brothers films that he was in, including musicals, because I always liked musicals. So I loved that there was this incredibly spunky actor who could do musicals and gangster films. And I really got into a whole other world of movies. It kind of helped me depart from horror. So I consider it a fulcrum in my life, that one biopic. Sure.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Who did direct it, Joe?
Joseph Pevney, but he was one of the sort of contract guys that they had at Universal at the time. That was positioned as their Golden Jubilee movie or some anniversary they were supposedly having in 1957. And so there was a huge hoopla about it. And of course, it's, you know, it's not exactly verbatim as to how it really happened.
they
took a lot of liberties, but it's good.
There's quite a bit of tragedy in it. Of course, he had deaf parents, which was, you know, sort of shoot in as an explanation, but there was also great conflict with his wife, and just there was some aspect of the tragedy of it that I think played into my sense of self-pity. Even at that age, I was already feeling like the burden of showbiz and, you know, playing monsters as an expression of your outsiderness. So it really spoke to me, and then, as I say, it was sort of my gateway to other types of movies, like the gangster films. The social realism of Warner Brothers really spoke to me. And Cagney was a cool actor, because I always liked that he, you know, was beloved and so on, but he was always fighting this system and fighting his bosses, and he started the Screen Actors Guild with Betty Davis, and they were all scrappy and fighting for workers' rights. And so there was a sense of, and then he left showbiz in 1961. He just said, I've had enough, and he became a farmer in Martha's Vineyard. And I just liked his aesthetic of being a person first, and showbiz was something he clearly cared about, but he never let it lead him and own him.
Yeah. He was, I think my first awareness of him was like through Bugs Bunny cartoons. You know, because I kind of remember seeing some movie, I can't remember what, and recognizing that, oh, this is that guy.
That's right. Well, and they also, of course, and maybe this is what you're thinking of, but, you know, the Edward G. Robinson voice was made famous in the cartoons as well. That's Shark, like you, Shay. Get it? That was Edward G., who's another fantastic actor. I just watched Scarlet Street the other day. What a wacky movie.
That's great.
Yeah, he's so good. Oh, wow. But that's cool. But I love how, it's sort of like, so that movie sort of cracked the door through your love of genre and kind of pulled you into other stuff.
Because
that's the thing, I guess, with horror and stuff like that, is you sort of become attached to kind of actors. So it's like you start going, you know, ooh, Karloff, I'll go see a Karloff movie.
Oh, absolutely. And and then, you know, years later, I became drawn to movies through the actors. You know, when I did sort of speak come of age in the 70s, it was Jack Nicholson and then De Niro and Hoffman. And, you know, these are classic cliches of my generation, but they really were, you would track them for their movies. And it was less clear to me the role of the director. Although I like to point out a movie called Suspicion, which is, I think by some accounts, a lesser Hitchcock, but to me, it's actually the epitome of Hitchcock because it's got great humor, has a strong woman, Joan Fontaine, and Cary Grant, who's just one of my favorites. I always liked the old movie stars, and he among them was one of my favorites. But the point is, I saw Suspicion when I was really quite young, and I didn't really understand what films were. Nowadays, this generation, they don't even understand that this isn't all very obvious. But in the old days, you just watched stuff on television. You didn't know what you would see and how important the director was. But I felt something. I felt the sense of suspense, the humor, the control, the glowing milk, you know.
Glowing milk.
So there were things that were happening in that movie that I think entranced me. And I just knew I was in the hands of a great director or a great something. And it's fun now. In retrospect, I still cite Hitchcock as my favorite filmmaker. And it's, I just intuited it as a kid. And the other thing about that movie that I love to think about is that he sort of disowned it and said that he couldn't have the ending he wanted. But I actually don't believe that. I think that's Hitch building his own mythology, because the actual way the real movie or the original story ends is a letdown. It's not as good. And it would have been a movie called Premonition, because she would have been right to suspect her husband. But the beauty is, maybe because Hitchcock was forced into a happy ending, you remain unsure if the Cary Grant character is a lout and a murderer. And so therefore you are left with a feeling of suspicion. So
yeah, my defense. Nice. Yeah.
Hence the title.
Yes.
Exactly.
But it's true. It's funny because, there would be Hitchcock films that I would enjoy as a kid that you know, if it were another director, they wouldn't have roped you in as much. And I think...
Don't say rope.
Rope would, like, as a kid, I don't know if that would... But because I saw it first when they re-released it, I guess. When was that, like, early 80s?
Well, it was out of... A whole bunch of those pictures were out of circulation for many years.
But as a kid, there was just... You know, I couldn't enunciate it, but now, and you've sort of said, you know, when you talk about the milk and things like that, he's having fun. He's having fun with the medium. And like, you're 9 years old and you can recognize that, even if it's all these sophisticated adults in a world you don't understand, you know?
Absolutely. And the lady vanishes. A lot of the early ones, there's just something going on. And Guillermo del Toro said that. I just saw an interview, but I always thought he was very articulate in pointing out that you can read a Hitchcock movie. You can actually see his choices. And some people feel that's very mannered, but I feel like it's watching, you know, a bit of sculpture. as mm-hmm. well as you're involved with the story, because he, despite his, you know, not liking actors, of course, he knew perfectly well the actors were why you're watching the movie. So, but the craft, sort of being able to see, oh, this is a long shot that's going from, you know, a wide to somebody blinking, you can feel that there's a thought, that that's an articulated sentence, that there's real craft. It's just a delight. And you're right, I think even a kid can read that. And it's a wonderful introduction to cinema, and you can come back to it over and over.
Yeah. It's just a sense of fun, even in the really dark stuff.
What
I love. Cool. What else do you got?
Well, I have to talk about Night of the Living Dead because, you know, I grew up on the Universal Pictures like Frankenstein. I love the Wolfman. I love the Creature from the Black Lagoon. And I like all the spinoffs. It was fun, the mashups. When you had Glenn Strange playing the monster instead of, you know, and then when Bella played it, it was crazy because it didn't look good. So there's this whole legacy. If you're a Universal horror fan, you know, you really pick apart all the things. And it was so crazy that Bela Lugosi, who was Dracula, was playing the Hunchback, but the Hunchback was Fritz Lang. Anyway, on it goes. So you're obsessed with all of this. And then one night I see a show called Night of the Living Dead. And it's in black and white. Seems great. I'm going to watch it. My parents are already in bed. And I settle down to this, what appears to just be another sort of quirky black and white horror film. And there was something about it that just seemed to almost torque. And I was like, this is so dark. And also the thing that's charming is in the beginning, the first zombie that comes and the tormenting brother says to his sister, they're coming to get you, Barbara. So I was like, that's so meta before meta was meta. Like, that's so weird. They seem to be referencing, you know, Karloff. And
they've seen horror films.
Yeah, and like, what's happening? My brain started to sort of fracture. And then the course of events was just much more desolate and slightly appalling. And it was what I'm obviously saying is that it was the ushering in of a new generation of horror makers. But because it was black and white, you felt still oriented. Obviously, his follow-up was this gaudy color film, which I actually don't love as much as most people. Some people go so far as to say Dawn is a better film. But to me, the austerity of Night of the Living Dead and the struggle, and of course the political underpinnings, which he insists he wasn't doing on purpose, but it has a feeling of 1968, the racial tension, the white family in the basement, and the fantastic, all the weird stuff, the black guy slapping the silly white woman, all of this is really wonderfully shocking. And, you know, it felt wildly contemporary. My little television that had played me just a nice Karloff movie only days before. So I felt very, shocked in the best way. So that's still, when people say my favorite movie, or at least horror film, I cite good old Night of the Living Dead. Also, years later, you realize, oh my God, it's an indie film, so resourceful, so fantastic.
I remember, I think, were you there, Joe, when was it a double screening of that? And maybe it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the Cinematheque, and they were showing the new Criterion print of Night of the Living Dead. And I had not seen it. You know, it was a movie I'd seen 1,300 times.
Well, but often looking terrible because it fell into the public domain.
Yeah. But I had not seen it in years. And it was just, you know, and you're like, oh, this will be fun. It'll be nice to see how it looks. I couldn't believe how immersed I got into it immediately. It was just, you know, you can almost see a film too many times. And it was kind of nice to have taken a break and to see this new version. But it's an unbelievable movie. And I'm with you. And maybe I'll cut this in retrospect. I you can say this on the public record. I'm going to be, but Dawn of the Dead, I mean, I loved it the first time I saw it because it's all surprising. But when I go back to it, it's too friggin' long. It's just a little slow, right?
I think the word is indulgent.
Okay, is that?
Woo, now it can fit.
Isn't it all indulgent, Joe? If you're not indulging yourself with your movie.
Well, yeah, but you know, when you're doing a 75-minute story and you're playing it out at 2.5 hours, it's going to suffer from it. because it gets repetitious.
There's some great stuff, though, of course. But my issue was that, you know, the color took away from some of the effects. Like the zombies were they white? I don't know. There's something about it. It all just got a little. And you know, of course, the good thing about it is how it plays as satire and a commentary on commercialism, and all of that's wonderful. But it didn't feel as truly somber as the first one.
Well, yeah, and there is that thing, and I mean, other people have noted it, that black and white just feels more realistic somehow.
Well, it's like a newsreel. It's shot like a newsreel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But there's something about the black and white in every version I've seen, from the crappy old VHS ones to the new print. There's something distinct about the look of that movie, just the sheen of it, the tonality of it. That's just, that alone is just disturbing and creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah. I can't even remember, but yeah, stumbling across it on TV thinking, you know, it's just going to be another monster movie. Wow.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, she...
Or call the police.
She should have, exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Another movie that I thought of for this, and you know, now we enter into the world perhaps of cliche because it's Taxi Driver, but there's something about Taxi Driver that is, well, first of all, it is a lot of these other movies I've mentioned I pretty much saw on TV, but Taxi Driver, I was finally my own man. I was able to go to the theater. That was what, 76 maybe? Yep. So I would have been 16 now. Is that possible? I know where I saw it, 86th Street, and I don't know what I was anticipating, because I wasn't necessarily a De Niro fan yet, but I was compelled to see this movie. And I don't know, that movie to this day, it sits in the mind. It's the colors, it's the amazing soundtrack, which of course now we know is a holdover from Hitchcock, so that had a beautiful haunting quality. It was indeed the testosterone and the pathos of De Niro, but Albert Brooks, I mean, all the secondary characters, seeing Keitel in a smaller role. Maybe I had seen Mean Street. I really don't think so. I think it was Taxi Driver, just as the seminal, and to this day, it sits in the mind as just a work of art. It's almost, well, it's everything cinema should be, but in any case, it's just more than a movie. And the other thing is that, I could never follow it. I couldn't understand what was happening. You know, one minute he seems to be, he's going to go shoot the politician. So it was also this kind of fracturing of narrative storytelling. It really didn't follow a straight trajectory. It just seemed to be sort of cascading like his dementia.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one reason. It doesn't fully resolve. It's a series of odd set pieces, you know, when he buys the guns from that guy. And you also felt the authenticity of these bit players. Yeah. And then obviously Jodie Foster was just so entrancing. And even to the point where as a young kid, I noticed that the one love scene with, or whatever, the slow dance with Keitel and Jodie Foster was, that was not in Travis's subjective mind. So I remember thinking back, what's that doing in the movie? So even then I was already in some way becoming a little tiny film Nazi with my own opinions about subjectivity, which maybe I had learned from Hitchcock or something. But I remember that seemed like this weird scene. And was it therefore maybe just a projection of De Niro's thing? Who knows?
That's an interesting, yeah, I've never thought about that. And also, if nothing else, it's it puts you in a position where you have just absolutely no problem with whatever's going to happen to Harvey Keitel, because that remains one of the creepiest scenes I've ever seen in my life.
And what a beautiful performance, the two of them. And you know, believe it or not, Keitel was being invited to play the Albert Brooks character, which would have been very strange and not as charming, because some of the best stuff in the movie is when he's like, well, the guy at the newsstand, you know, he has this finger and this finger. Well, I just got my thumb back, thank God. You know, all of this little comedic stuff that he's obviously improvising. Everything about it, the Marty backseat scene, you know, these were seminal things that really stuck in the mind to this day. And I always joke that, you know, speaking of film format, I have the VHS, I have the fucking DVD, I have the DVD special edition, I have the Blu-ray. The
No, you know, Laserdisc? You didn't buy the Taxi Driver Laserdisc?
I have Cuckoo's Nest on Laserdisc.
I actually, know what I'm joking, but that was why I ended up buying a Laserdisc player. I was not rolling in money, I was working crew, and Taxi Driver was the first. I knew Criterion had started doing these things, and Taxi Driver came out with a Scorsese commentary, which in... what is that, Joe? 1943 or something? This is, you're like, are you fucking kidding me? He's talking over the entire film about making, I have to have this. It was like, I had to spend $1,000 on the machine and $200 on the disc just to hear this.
Have you tried playing it lately?
No, I was really disappointed finally, because it's mostly just him telling stories about shit that happened while they're making the movie.
Yeah.
And I was looking, but then when he started doing.
Your laser disc, it probably isn't going.
It's probably rotted. Yeah,
it's probably rotted because they all got laser rot from the.
But then, do you remember he did? He started doing Michael Powell films where he do commentaries, and you would get, because he wasn't just telling personal stories, and you would get more insight into the making of those films, both in how Michael Powell worked, but you also got this amazing insight into how Scorsese thought about film, which was so much more interesting than listening to him talk about the time they, you know, all got noodles after they wrapped the scene in the, you know, at the movie theater or something. Sorry, didn't mean that.
That's a great, the making of on the Blu-ray or whatever is very charming, though, to see some of their process. And of course, they were shooting in an abandoned building, and the fact that they cut a hole in the floor for the overhead shot at the end, it's really cool to see. And it makes you feel like we're just not trying hard enough, because we're not, you know, sawing buildings in half to get our job. So anyway, Marty's
in my day.
Yeah, back in my day, we saw that ceiling. One movie that I put on my list, which is almost random, but I did want to sort of celebrate other kinds of cinema. And also, I grew up in New York, and my parents were pretty cultured, so they would, you know, in my day, in the early 70s, when a new Truffaut movie came out, or a new even Godard, you know, you were aware of this because I was in a big city. So in acknowledgement of that, I put a movie called Playtime on my list, which is Jacques Tati. And there was something about Jacques Tati, for all my obviously love of the dark arts, you know, there was something about his observation of life that has influenced me and that I delight in, which is these sort of wide shots where he's commenting on modern life and the absurdity of it and sort of the overly cleanse, you know, the dehumanizing. I mean, that was a theme in the 60s, obviously. But his use of sound, like squeaky shoes. You'll just see a wide shot of a hallway and a guy coming down this hallway, and it's just like squeak, 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 squeak. I mean, I don't know if it's French or if it's just something about Jacques Tati himself, but I just wanted to celebrate something a little offbeat. And he had, you know, his own miseries in his career. That was the most expensive movie made in France at the time. And, you know, this wildly ambitious film that to anyone's eyes was quite simple in its ambition, but, you know, he really did build these these sets that spoke about new glass facades and sort of the dehumanizing of modern life. So I don't know. I thought he would be fun to throw in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's great. I mean, and clearly more than a lot of people who spend a lot of time in the genre you have chosen, your movies do feel like they're made by someone who's seen something other than John Carpenter's The Thing.
Which is one of my favorites.
Well, yeah, sure. but there is that sense. I think it's one of the things, you know, even watching Habit, where I was like, this is, especially then, it was just this sort of like, this is a serious filmmaker. And I love horror. I don't mean to, but you know what I'm saying? Where I was like, this is somebody who's bringing this kind of really interesting aesthetic into the genre that I've not seen that often.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of horror proper, so to speak, it's funny that I know exactly where I was when I saw The Howling. I remember the screening, and there was it was the two werewolf movies came out. I don't remember which was which. In a funny way, American Werewolf in London, I always felt was just a teeny bit too snarky for me. And, you know, I still revere it. Obviously, that's when both those films, we were having this thrill of the new werewolf makeup. So that was just absolutely amazing for me. I grew up, my favorite monster was Wolfman. And so to see this new take on werewolves, which had been sorely overlooked. I mean, I do like the makeup for I'm a Teenage Werewolf, but I don't even know if I ever saw the movie.
That's not a bad movie, actually, of those of type.
yeah, absolutely. But, you know, anyway, there's something about seeing these two werewolf movies. And as I say, I thought that Landis was a little cheeky. It still was cool because there was a sense of realism, you know, being perplexed by being a werewolf. And I appreciated that. But both those movies were seminal, and I'm sorry, have we topped them yet? Joe, what do you think?
Well, there have been some good werewolf movies. Ginger Snaps was pretty good.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's not, it's a genre that's tricky because it doesn't really have anywhere to go. You know, when they did American Werewolf in Paris, much to Landis's chagrin, you know, and they said, well, we'll do a CGI werewolf, you know, and it just doesn't work. It's just, yeah. You don't believe a word of it, a frame of it. It's just not right. There's no weight. There's no, the movement is wrong.
I'm about to say something that's going to get me smacked the next time I see you. And Joe knows how much I love The Howling. I think it is one of the great, I think it's the great werewolf movie, the second half of the 20th century. But I do have to point out, doesn't The Howling have animated werewolves in it, Joe? Are you?
Yes, it does, because that was the only way we could afford to do that transformation.
That's a tradition, actually. You know, remember this started with The Thing. The Thing has that whole section where it goes to a miniature, and it's bananas, right?
Yeah.
So
Rob did it just right after. He did it right after The Howling.
Yeah, and Terminator goes to little animations as well. I mean, These are the great charms of those movies because they were right at the end of practical effects. Now, having said that, I think that Joe Johnson's poor Wolfman, it suffers, but you know, there's a nice movie in there. In other words, Benicio as Larry Talbot. I thought that was great casting, and I feel he has a soulful thing to offer. But that movie,
That movie was messed up by the studio. I mean, it was they took it away from the director. They reshot stuff. They burned up Rick Baker's models, you know, on camera, and they treated him very poorly. And he got out of the business after making that movie. He just said, yeah. I can't work like this because I can't work for people who don't respect what I do. And the problem with that movie, which looks great, is that it just is made by people who don't seem to understand how to make a movie like that. And if you go down their list of the Van Helsings and all those other things they've been doing, they just don't get it. You know,
this is the legacy of horror, what am I trying to say, of Hollywood trying to do horror. They literally do not understand the genre. They did the Tom Cruise Mummy. You know, I love Coppola's Dracula, and I sort of, at least I'm amused by the De Niro Frankenstein, because that's so bananas. When I talked about Taxi Driver, imagine my two worlds coming together, that De Niro's about to play the monster. That movie doesn't work, but it's okay. Anyway, at least they were trying, and that has some dark stuff. They made it so that the bride was actually, Frankenstein, the doctor's girlfriend, Liz, I think. So it was dark, at least, and that was the point. But the new Hollywood doesn't know how to make horror. They know how to make adventure and superheroes and people, men in tights.
But we had Lee Winnell on the show a while back. It was before the film had come out, and he talked about he'd just gotten Invisible Man, which I thought he did a great job with. And he said his pitch, he went into them, and they were trying to figure out what to do now that the Dark Universe had sort of fallen apart. And literally his pitch to the studio for the Invisible Man was, because they're like, what do we do with this guy? Like, you can't hurt him. He's invisible. He's this. And Lee went in and he said, we're going to make him the bad guy. And they went, oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Has anyone seen the James Whale Invisible Man?
No. When I was trying to do a remake of The Mummy, the reason they didn't want to make it was because it was a modern take, and they said we want it to be a period picture like the first Mummy, which of course was not a period.
It's not a period
picture.
Exactly. And it's so discouraging. And in a way, they should just leave it alone. Now, of course, with the Invisible Man, they are going to go for it. I happen to know. You guys must know. I mean, and it's funny. We're all shut out of the. They're going to get a bunch of youngsters, and it's fine. But I'll tell you, if I could say this is terrible on the record, my problem with the Invisible Man was that it was a suit, and so to me, it's just a little bit teetering on. Well, now she'll put the suit on for the sequel, and she'll go bust some heads. So it's a little bit playing a little close to the superhero vibe, you know. Whereas the old trope was, taking a potion that changed your personality, in this case, physically. I mean, it's a Jekyll and Hyde story, but Claude Rains' performance, he's fucking batshit crazy. And that's what really is amazing about it. He has a superpower, but it's that he's crazy that's the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just don't think, we'll see. I'm sure this new slate, there'll be something good going on, but I still don't trust. You know, the whole point of horror is to really express some of the dark themes of life and morality and rage and dysfunction.
Hard to do that by committee.
Precisely.
Joe, I was just talking to some friends the other night, and I was like, I need to remember to ask Joe, and I could probably look at my Blu-ray and find out. But did you direct the Ed Begley Invisible Man?
No,
stuff?
I didn't. I wanted to.
Oh, okay.
It was already taken. Carl Gottlieb had it.
Oh, okay.
And he did a great job of it. But
Gottlieb directed something?
Yeah, he directed a couple of segments of Amazon Woman on the Moon, which is a sketch movie.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And it's Ed Begley Jr. as the Invisible Man, or he thinks he's invisible.
He's the only one who thinks he's invisible. Actually, he's just a naked guy running around, and they're all indulging him. It's very funny.
That's pretty good.
Which was all, I was always fascinated by that as a kid. That the monster's a naked.
Now there's a new Kino Lorber Blu-ray of Amazon Woman on the Moon with all sorts of extras.
I have it.
Hooray for Kino Lorber.
Yes.
They're doing a great job, actually.
Yeah. I have a couple movies on Kino when it was Kino, and I have a couple, and Lorber bought Abbott back in the day and put out that VHS you described.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Not the one I had, I promise you. nobody had paid for that one. That seems like a natural. Your Blu-ray set.
Oh yeah. Well, that was Shout Factory, and they're also fantastic for.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, they're very good.
They did one. I'm an idiot.
Yeah, they did a Blu-ray set. Oh, I thought you were. No, it really happened. It was one of those. You know, when you're at my level of showbiz, it's all just sort of self-promotion. I'm really just like the guy busking on the corner. So what I did is IFC had bought some of my movies, and I figured out how to get Wendigo, one of my films, under their umbrella. And I got all my movies all to be bought by IFC. And then I said, well, naturally, since you own my whole collection, we need to put out a Blu-ray set. So I went to Shout Factory and I pitched it to them. And I'll never forget that they said, well, we're going to have a meeting about it. And they came back and they said, well, we did the numbers and we'll do it. You could tell it was like, it was just this close. I was so excited that somehow my numbers, how did that ever happen? So I orchestrated it and they made it beautiful, did a great job. And then the fun thing is that then IFC and Shout Factory became partners and they feed each other titles. So, you know, whatever, I'm the origin story of probably where they really made money on other things, but I feel okay.
Yeah, Josh was getting you mixed up with the Synapse box set of Al Adams and stuff.
No, I want to do this.
I'm often confused.
I feel terrible. These are sort of things that, if we were pros, I'd have figured out. But yeah, I'm looking at the Larry Fessenden collection, still in print. I just ordered the Blu-ray, so I hope that makes up for my.
Hey, you're always worth coming in. You made a sale.
There you go. You just made 43 cents or whatever it is.
7 cents. Man, I'm drinking tonight.
Yeah. And then I'm gonna fly out to New York and sit outside your doorstep and make you autograph it for me someday.
Ah, certainly. Certainly.
Well, that's great. But there needs to be a bigger one. You've got way more than these.
I agree. And I have, never mind me. So another movie I wanted to celebrate, I'm not sure why. In other words, it's later, but is Fargo. I just think Fargo, everybody loves the Coen brothers, and they've made great stuff since. But there's something very austere and simple, and it sits in the mind. I like these movies. I referenced The Taxi Driver. It just sits there as a color and a series of a mood. Fargo is also, it's a snow movie, which I really love. And in a way, that's a whole, The Thing, of course, is a snow movie. I tried to make a snow movie too. But anyway, Fargo has just such a heart to it. I think Frances McDormand is so sweet and surrounded by real chaos. And, it's a theme that the Coens come back to often, which is, that the world just makes no sense. But here, I think they treat that with great tenderness and pathos and satire. There are just so many great scenes of a guy getting himself into more and more trouble, the car salesman. And it was also, I guess they'd already made a couple movies and they were already a thing, but it was kind of still when indie films, they were at the Oscars, but they were also at the Spirit Awards.
Right.
They felt like they were still one of us.
It's still at that point where you're hoping their next one will be as good as the last one, as opposed to now, where it's like pretty much certain it will be.
And by many accounts, some people will stand by Raising Arizona, and that's fantastic. And I borrowed their camera work from that movie. It had a big influence on stuff I had done. It felt like the Coens were an example of indie success. And I mean outside of the genre, because we've always had scrappy filmmakers like Romero and Carpenter and whoever else, and all of us really. But it was fun to see the indie guys sort of staking their claim. In the Hollywood.
Well, there's a kind of veneer of horror to that film too.
That's the point.
Wood chipper scene, anyone?
The wood chipper scene, but the one to me that's always, it's not, obviously nothing compares to that. It's when Peter Stormare is just sitting in the back of her car and she's just trying to grapple with him, and what he means and what he is. And that's just,
well, that's what I mean about heart. The fact that she says, why would you do this?
Why would you do such a thing?
And, in her sweet little accent, but it's so profound. It could have been Hannibal Lecter back there. Could have been the end of Seven, but instead it's this movie that has other qualities. And there's great tenderness to that film. And then...
And she's also asking questions that you're not used to, because nobody in Seven asks Kevin Spacey that. Nobody asks Hannibal Lecter, why would you do such terrible things?
Well, exactly. It's assumed because you're in a horror picture.
Yeah.
Also, the blood
The gore that they use is fantastic. When Buscemi just gets that really random cut, and then he's got the napkin stuck to his face, and it's just like, I really love horror or violence that feels, real. I mean, that's not saying much, but you know, a lot of horror, we have heightened violence, and that's one thing, but it's really fun to bring it back to just the physical inconvenience of having your, obviously Henry Serial Killer, you mentioned Texas Chainsaw, you know, these are, and then Man Bites Dog, you guys know that film? Well, I've only seen it once. I own it. It's on my shelf.
I've only seen it once too, because I don't think I could ever watch it again.
I don't think so, but it sits in the mind, as I like.
It's like a pebble in your shoe, except it's in your brain. You know, I mean, I like to tell this story that when I was doing a picture for Warner Brothers, a Looney Tunes with, you know, a Bugs Bunny movie.
Yeah.
The guy I had to deal with, who was running the studio, had a gigantic 3-sheet for Man Bites Dog in his office. And you would walk past the 3-sheet, which is a guy with a gun pointing it down to the bottom of the 3-sheet. And from the bottom of it comes blood and a baby rattle.
Pacifier, right?
Or pacifier. Whatever. And this guy loves this movie enough to have it on his wall and see it every day. And he's telling me how to make a comedy about Bugs Bunny.
That's fucking nuts, man.
That's a mixed message meeting. I'm with you. I don't ever need to see it again. And I also own it. The one I guess I'm maturing, because they've come out with a Blu-ray now of Irreversible that contains a version of it back in narrative order as opposed to backwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That just makes me say no.
Well, I'm saying it. I'm like, no. That's an amazing movie. this is what I got to work with. And I'm like, oh, that would be interesting to see. And then I go, yeah, then I'd have to see Irreversible again.
Yeah, exactly. Then I'd have to see Reversible.
Exactly.
Well, you could do the same thing with Memento, too. I mean, you could find all these stories
I could sit through
and put
Memento
them back again. Into chronological order.
I could sit through Memento again.
The reason I appreciate this digression is that I have what I call my hardcore shelf. And it is, in fact, Irreversible, Man Bites Dog, Henry Serial Killer, also Funny Games, the original, which is a movie I actually dislike, because I disagree with the premise of what's his name, that I'm going to movies to see people tortured. That's actually not why I even like horror movies. So I actually disagree fervently with his assumption about the audience. However,
yes, thank you.
He believed it enough to make a remake of it.
Damn remake. but there's still, at its core, and this is maybe before Inside and some of the French extreme, this was still when extreme horror was pretty shocking. And I think that the core murder and also killing the kid, you know, if you're a parent, it's almost more than I can take. So once again, only seen it once, never need to see it again, often cited as an annoyance, but it does belong on that shelf of the ultra-violent movies that are art versus, you know.
Well, it's very clever movie. I mean, it's a very clever premise, and it's really well done, and it's got a lot of funny things in it. You know, the fact that there's another group of filmmakers shooting another serial killer that they run into. I mean, it's just full of really clever things, but it's the most nihilistic movie that I've ever seen, and it just put me in a place mentally that I don't think I want to go back to.
I agree. And I rented it with my wife, I think on VHS. And we were like, oh, well, what's this going to be? And hard for life.
I remember going to Sundance. It was the only time I was ever there. And I was going on the dime of this producer who was, you know, putting us up and everything. And we had, for whatever reason, every movie we went to see that year was just bad. But I was really excited because we had tickets or the new one from the guy who had made I Stand Alone, which was Irreversible. And I remember the last minute, one of us got an invite. It was like an ICM party or something. I'm like, who the fuck? I live in LA. I can go to an ICM. I want to see this movie. But the guy who was sort of footing our bill was like, I want to go to this party. And we're like, ugh. And I gave away my Irreversible tickets. And I still remember walking past the theater to get to the ICM party. And it was like 10 after 8. The movie had started at 8. And we're walking past the theater, Arrowverse was showing, and people were stumbling out into the street, pale and falling down and crying. And I'm like, God damn it! I could have been in there.
Oh, guys. So on the shelf next to those movies, do you know the film Angst?
Oh, God, yeah.
No, you got to see this movie. It's just a very never recover from it kind of movie.
Yeah. That's a film festival. Just show that shelf.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
By the last night of the thing, no one's coming to that. Wow. Yeah, Angst. Oh, my God. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for these great memories.
Well, on my list, I think I have The Shining. You know, it fits into my category of works of art. I mean, you could probably say that. And I might even prefer Dr. Strangelove. You know, the thing about Kubrick is you have such a nice small selection. You can sort of decide on your mood which one you want to favor. Obviously, Clockwork Orange. But in a funny way, yeah, I mean, maybe it is Dr. Strangelove. There's something about that, the blend of humor and Peter Sellers doing the three roles. Nevertheless, I said The Shining because I've always been a Nicholson fan. And when I saw that movie, I didn't like it. I saw it in the same theater where I saw Taxi Driver. This was on 86th Street. It's not that I didn't like it, but I was a little confused and it was too bright. And, you know, all the things that, of course, are so wonderful about it. But it also stays with you and it's just a strange sculpture. I mean, even now when you rewatch it, everything is so oddly slow, you know, Scatman's performance, and you're like, what is happening? This is just not real life. And of course, the almost as great as the film is the little 20-minute movie that his daughter made about it's a very precious glimpse behind the scenes. And Nicholson says, well, Stanley always wanted something different. He didn't want naturalism, and I had spent my life trying to be a naturalistic actor, and he pushed me into this other place. And I really feel, speaking of fulcrums, like Man of a Thousand Faces was a certain fulcrum for me. There's something about Nicholson. He never really recovered, and from then on, he always became a wonderful Jack Nicholson imitator.
Right. No, that's a good, but like, yeah, the Jack Nicholson pre-Shining could not have played the Joker in Batman.
Exactly. And mind you, also on my list, for what it's worth, is Cuckoo's Nest, which I think is one of the great ensemble pieces ever put together. Obviously, Milos, she did something with that group. Every one of them became famous. I mean, they're all playing misfits, and suddenly they're the star of Back to the Future. And
Break, Taxi.
And Taxi. Taxi. Who would have known? How would Danny DeVito have had a career without this seminal
piece? That's true. Imagine, yeah, that guy's going to be a huge star.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy from The Hills Have Eyes.
Right. Michael Berryman shows up in that.
Kind of wonderful. Who's a great singer. He was in a movie we did, and there's a lovely behind the scenes where he just goes into some opera, and everybody on the set is like, what? Wow. So, but Cuckoo's Nest is just a treasure. And, you know, it's also spoke to me in my teens about rebellion, all the good stuff that's all been distorted in the modern world, but when there was still the idea of rebelling against the man, or in this case, the nurse.
I've got two directors here who seem to be on the same page with these things. Why? And I have some ideas, but I don't think I can enunciate them. As you say, The Shining is very deliberately paced, but it is not a slow movie. And why is The Shining not a slow movie and Dawn of the Dead is?
Because The Shining is hypnotic, as in the way that many of Kubrick's movies are hypnotic. Barry Lyndon is hypnotic. But as good as George was at doing what he did in Night of the Living Dead, he wasn't on that level. He wasn't on the level of Kubrick. He wasn't doing that kind of work. And he came from industrial films, you know, where the idea is you present your idea and get off and get to the next idea. Yeah. And I don't think the two movies are comparable.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Well, what is it? It is wonderful to think about Kubrick. There's a special sauce there. I mean, as I've referenced, I love Marty. I love a lot of these giants of cinema. Even Spielberg is just fun to watch his craft. But what is it? There's something in Kubrick that is mesmerizing, and it's not dazzling. It's just very still, and yet there's some other stuff. It's just a fantastic blend, hard to put your finger on.
Yeah.
One other maestro that I wanted to reference is, and through maybe one of his less cherished films or whatever the word is The Tenant by our boy Roman Polanski. Yeah. A big influence on me to some degree on the movie Habit that I made. And that is everything that's amazing about Polanski, which is this real detailed naturalism. And then when he wants, you can tell he's like, oh, fantasy films, ha, ha, ha. You know, Rosemary's Baby, ha, ha, ha. But effortlessly, he can bring in a sense of dread and menace and, you know, satanic flavoring. And in the case of The Tenant, it's just like, I actually, like Taxi Driver, it's a movie that I delight in not quite knowing what the hell's going on. You know, clearly this guy is having troubles getting along, but there's a feeling of alienation and just some slight hysteria. I am not Simon Schul. I want chocolate, not coffee. And just this whole thing. And the fact that it's Polanski is very charming. And my brother sent me to this double feature when I was little. He said, I want you to go to these movies. And first I saw Knife in the Water, and I recognized that this was a really well-crafted movie. And I thought, that's cool. Why did my brother send me to this? I can't wait to see the second on the bill. And then came The Tenant, and I just related to it so deeply in terms of the sense of horror, the sense of the color of the way he depicts Paris and the alienation and the pathos of this guy who's really quite timid, just succumbing to paranoia. So I count myself among, I'm a Polanski fan. I always say the judge that sent him out of the country ruined him, because he's never made as good a movies as his American period, in my opinion. But The Tenant is a real gem. And so is Cul-de-Sac, a completely bananas film with,
Lionel Stander.
Donald.
Yes, Lionel Stander.
Yeah. Oh my God. They didn't get along. He was apparently just a brute on set, but he's so great in the movie.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. And let me get, and there's also that, directors starring themselves in their own movies that may have spoken to you in some fashion, or?
Yeah, I think so. And it's a trilogy. They call it the Apartment Trilogy, obviously, Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, and then The Tenant. And to me, The Tenant is sort of somehow the most appealing, and maybe it's because it's Roman himself in there showing his vulnerability. I mean, of course, he's now been a little bit canceled and, you know, reviled.
A little bit canceled. he can't even get his last movie shown here, and it's supposed to be really good.
Oh, is it?
That's the Dreyfus movie? Yeah, it's supposed to be terrific.
Well, didn't it win somewhere? And then
I won a bunch of awards and stuff, but they nobody will buy it. No streaming service will carry it because he's canceled.
It's fucking bananas. Anyway, I don't know what. We'll get canceled if we go on about that. But I'll tell you, he's still a great artist. And
the good news is we never release these, so nobody ever hears them, so don't worry.
We just do them for ourselves.
Me and Joe, we just like to talk to people.
Let me tell you what I really think. You know how I was basically listing a bunch of classics? Well, let me tell you what pictures I really like.
let me also break with our tradition, because you brought up Scorsese a couple times, and you're in a movie of his that I feel inexplicably doesn't get talked about very much, and that I love with a
passion. Thank you for saying that.
And I would imagine that you have, just by nature, I've been in it, had more conversations with people who love that movie than I have. Because, you know, I don't walk down the street and people who love Bringing Out the Dead don't walk up to me. But what do you, what I don't even know what I'm trying to say. Why do you think that is? What is?
Well, you know, you think of like Bob Dylan. There's some albums in there that just get lost. And yet if you put it on, you're like, oh my fucking God, if this wasn't Dylan, this would be right. The guy's greatest work. So there's something about Bringing Out the Dead that's, it's just one among many wonderful films, but it has such an atmosphere, and an atmosphere of sort of brooding despair about the city. And yet, of course, the thing about Marty is that he is always engaged with spiritual issues, which is like something, don't tell the fans of Goodfellas and Taxi Driver that that's really what he's making movies about. But it really is there on the screen in, you know, the character Nicolas Cage says, I'm nothing but a grief mop, which I love that idea of just absorbing people's despair in their last moments, because he's obviously a paramedic. Also, it has great performances by John Goodman and is it Bing Rames or is it Sizemore?
And
as usual, Marty has a great soundtrack. It's really atmospheric, and it's Paul Schrader, so it should be considered one of their New York trilogies. What's the other one anyway? What is the other one?
Departed. Raging Bull.
Wait, what you
said? Raging Bull, Taxi Driver. No, with Schrader.
Oh, with Schrader.
With Schrader. I guess Raging Bull, but is there something else? Anyway.
Last Temptation. Or
Last Temptation, that New York trilogy. Although, the funny thing is that Harvey Keitel's might as well be fucking in Brooklyn. He's like, yo, Jesus, what the fuck? It's the strangest performance in that movie. I don't know.
Very interesting. Thank you for that, though, because I love that movie, and it just seems to have
fallen from the radar.
Yeah. In a way, even after Hours, it's starting to get rediscovered by people, which is nice, because that one doesn't feel like Martin Scorsese film. You don't walk into that and go, oh, here comes Scorsese.
But, yeah, except for the camera moves. It's so bananas. Yeah. But, there's a career to delight in.
He's done all right.
And it's not over.
Oh, no, it's not.
Thanks to Netflix, he's actually making another movie.
Oh, my God. Good old Marty.
We should get that guy on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, he's seen a couple of pictures.
He's seen some pictures. That's the problem. So like Scorsese, it's like, what is he going to say that we haven't heard him say 20,000 times before? It's like,
but he'll say it really fast, which is
It can fit in a lot of information there in 1 hour.
That's right. That's right.
My Lord. Well, speaking of greatest movies ever made, Dead Zone is among them.
Oh, it'll always be when Greg Stolson was president for 4 years.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, how many times did you think this is the Greg Stilson? It's amazing. Trump really brought all of that home. I just wish Christopher Walken would have headed over there.
We'll cut that part.
Yes, and that is one of the great. I guess that's Jeffrey Boehm who wrote the script.
Yep.
You know, because I remember, I feel like the Dead Zone was the first King book I read, because I was reading as they were coming out, more or less, as a kid. And it was the first one where it was like not quite as great as, you know, it wasn't The Shining, it wasn't The Stand. And they made some changes, but the change that he made, because I don't know if you remember in the book or if you ever read it, he just grabs a kid out of the audience. And the decision to make the kid the child of the woman that he was going to marry, that it could have been his child, just gives it 1,000 pounds of emotional weight that it just doesn't have in the book.
That whole movie is an exercise in, I mean, you wouldn't think it would work, but it's so sprawling on the one hand, but it's just a series of really concise, you know, I still think about the scissors.
Oh.
The bathtub. Like, oh my God, it's just very memorable, and the snow and that gazebo, I mean, and the ice is going to break, you know, so many wonderful, evocative things. And it's
you're not allowed to say this, but it's really one of my favorite Cronenberg movies. You know, we're supposed to support each other's low budget efforts, but honestly, that and The Fly, two of things he did as adaptation, and of course, Your Picture.
I think he's gotten enough support for the. I think he got all the support he needed for the low budget ones. He's doing all right. It's okay.
He's doing just fine. Yeah. But I do. I just revere The Dead Zone for its efficiency as well as its heart, and it's also Christopher Walken.
That might be my favorite of his films.
It is mine.
And thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
Sorry. I knew Jeff. I knew the other writer too. You can be friends with two writers.
Yes.
Larry, thank you so much.
The film is Jacob's Wife. What's the where we live in this world now? I'm like, it's out there somewhere.
I know, it's so weird. I believe it's on Shudder on the 16th of April. And if I got that wrong, they don't pay me enough. What am I gonna promote their picture too now?
Well, here's the other great thing is it'll be there eventually anyway.
Well, but you know, once people get a look at you in this, you may get the lead in the remake of Going My Way or something like that.
You know? You waited a whole hour to say that.
And also I have to ask, and I can cut this if it's inappropriate. I forgot to wait until the end, because if you go, fuck you, mother. But as a gentleman who tends towards portliness myself, and I guess I hadn't seen you in anything in a little while, and I was like, oh, okay, so Larry's putting on some weight. Now I look at you now. Is it makeup? Did you do a De Niro for it? Did they just catch you?
I'll tell you the truth. And, you know, I'm very sensitive about my weight because it's just annoying. And I have been thin in my day, and I've been filmed thin and naked and all those things. So you really feel age creeping up on you. I think what was sweet is that, you know, they had the hair so cropped that I just looked like a big pimple. And then you have the collar and you're like, there's no way this guy could ever look good. And then, you know, the beige pants. I mean, so no, I probably was about the same weight, but I'm just styled in such a way to
it's amazing.
Bring out all the curves.
Yeah, I was generally startled when you popped up, and I was like, oh, okay, he took it all off. It's amazing. It's amazing. And I haven't seen you quite play that kind of part before. So it was,
And it's important. I mean, acting for me is about stripping away the vanity. So I knew that I was looking a lot around the edges. But
I think you should tell people you did it for the movie. I think you should say,
Actually, I spared you the joke, but that's what I say to everyone else.
Barbara looked good.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
Well, that's the other thing. Compared to Barbara, I look twice as bad.
Thank you so much, Larry. This has been a blast, and the movie's terrific, and I look forward to seeing many more from you, and can't wait for my Blu-ray set to get here. So
thanks, guys.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.